Coming up on Inside the Black Box, today's show is entitled The Battle Against Cancer, News from the Front Lines. And our guest to discuss this very fascinating topic will be Walter J. Curran, a physician who's the director of the Winship Cancer Center at Emory University, and Tim Fox, who's a medical physicist, also the director of the Division of Medical Physics at Emory University. And today's show will also underscore the fact that modern biomedical research often involves strange bedfellows. And I'm not implying anything weird about you guys. But, you know, a medical physicist who's actually, your degree is in nuclear engineering, working with a physician. This is actually a very common thing now in biomedical research, whereas a lot of people think maybe you guys wouldn't get along. Is that the case? You guys seem to get along okay, right? So it's not causing any problems?
No, not at all.
Okay. All right. That's good to hear, because that's what we're going to be talking on. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Hi, this is your radio friend, Joe Bizard, inviting you to tune into my country music classics here on WREK at 91.1. Friday evenings at 5 o'clock, we come alive at 5 with great old-time music. String bands, bluegrass, old country blues, a little of everything, jug bands, anything that you can imagine, you'll hear on the country music classics. All happy music. A little jug band. Don't forget, this is Friday at 5. We come alive right here with the country music classics on WREK-FM 91.1. Make it a habit. Tune in. Love to have you. That's Fridays at 5 right here on WREK 91.1.
Every 28 seconds, a car in the U.S. is stolen. What's even more shocking is that 25% of those vehicles had the keys inside. 60% were left unlocked, and 95% had no anti-theft devices. In times like these, protect yourself from auto theft by taking extra precautions. Never leave your vehicle running or with the keys in the ignition. Always lock your doors and keep your windows closed, even when parked in front of your own home. When away, park in busy, well-lighted places and never leave valuables in plain view. Equip your car or truck with an alarm or other theft deterrent device. Never leave your vehicle registration in your car. If you do become a victim of auto theft, report it immediately. Have your make, model, license plate, and vehicle ID number available to help authorities recover your vehicle. To learn more about protecting yourself from auto theft, visit ncpc.org or contact your local law enforcement agency.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this kid dumb? Now if I did, welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. Only funnier most days, at least. Today we're talking about cancer. I don't know how we're going to swing that one. We're going to do our best. I'm sure most people that treat cancer, suffer from cancer, have to deal with cancer, probably judiciously use their sense of humor to try to deal with the associated stress. But the title of today's program is The Battle Against Cancer, News from the Front Lines. And our guest from Emory University include Wally Curran, right? Wally said I could say Wally, so we're going to do Wally. And if Trent wants to chime in with a cheap joke about that, feel free. Who's the executive director of the Winship Cancer Institute at Emory University. He's been that since 2009. He joined the faculty there in 2008. He did his bachelor's degree and MD degrees at Dartmouth and the Medical College of Georgia, respectively, and residency at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center. He's, you know, authored a lot of papers, directed over 40 clinical trials, you know, he's a member of all sorts of things, which we would spend an hour listing all this stuff. But his research focuses on the management of patients with locally advanced lung cancer and malignant brain tumors. Perhaps he should check you out, Trent, while he's here. Wally is the only radiation oncologist to serve as the director of the National Cancer Institute, of a National Cancer Institute designated cancer center. Our other guest is Tim Fox, who's the director of the Division of Medical Physics and Associate Professor of Radiation Oncology at Emory University School of Medicine. Did his master's and PhD degree degrees in nuclear engineering right here at Georgia Tech. Right?
Correct.
All right.
Yes.
So it's good to have you back. And Tim's research centers on techniques for decision-making and automation that enable software systems to perform intelligently. Well, that would be a trick all in and of itself. If you could get my iPad to work, that would be great. But intelligently, specifically with respect to radiation oncology clinical environments. His research draws on areas such as artificial intelligence, constrained optimization methods, computational radiation dosimetry, and visualization methods, much of which we've actually talked about this program in the past. So, gentlemen, welcome to the program. And let's begin the program, as we often do, with...
Science in the News.
And our Science in the News article today comes from the September 26th issue of the New York Times, entitled Fighting Cervical Cancer with Vinegar and Ingenuity by Donald McNeil Jr., who often contributes to the Science Times section of the New York Times on Tuesdays. Dateline Thailand, Macau Panoimai, and I'm sure I'm butchering that name, did a little dance coming out of the examination room, swishing her hips. Oh, no, sorry, switching her hips. That's not nearly as risque. Waving her fists in the air and crowing in her limited English, everything's okay, everything's okay. The translation was that the nurse just told me that I do not have cervical cancer, and even the little white spot I had treated years ago is still gone. And this has to do with a very low-cost sort of diagnostic method that appears to be almost as effective and potentially much easier to implement and less costly than your typical pap smear. And it is helping physicians make a lot of inroads to end cervical cancer, at least end it as its number one, reign as the number one killer among women. The magic ingredient, household vinegar. Every year, more than 250,000 women die of cervical cancer, nearly 85% of them in poor and middle-income countries. Decades ago, it killed more American women than any other cancer. Now it lags far behind cancers of the lung, breast, colon, and skin. And let me remind you, this year, this month is, right, Breast yeah. Cancer Awareness Month, right? The lovely ladies from Zeta Tau Alpha, every time I come to the studio now during this month, they either hit me with a pink ribbon or today I got stickers, so I am not going to forget that. But in any case, apparently they call it, what, via cryotherapy, right? You basically take vinegar, which is a 5% solution of acetic acid and water, paint these various tumors or suspect areas of the cervix, and it turns the tumor white. I actually could not find the study that indicates why that does. It's obviously either got to be a reaction with the acid in the acetic acid or something about the high concentration of the acetic acid and a lot of tumors having different concentrations and distributions of water. So maybe it's an osmotic pressure effect. Either way, it makes these things show up white. And then they literally do what your favorite dermatologist does, take expanding carbon dioxide gas and freeze this off. Right, so they'll do this to warts and certain maladies of the skin, and supposedly it's making a lot of headway. So, so our guests today use very advanced methods for diagnosing these things. You know, is there some utility in these sort of easy to use diagnostic methods?
So this is Wally Kern, and good afternoon, everyone. The answer is absolutely yes. As Pete mentioned, this is the number one killer of cancer-related killer of women in some developing and third world countries. The pap smear, as well as a number of public health measures, have really reduced the mortality from this disease in this mm-hmm. country. This approach is really not so far away from approaches that are taken in gynecologist's office in this country. There are other compounds besides vinegar used, but a lot of the visual inspection of a woman's cervix by a gynecologist at an annual visit right here mm-hmm. in Atlanta does involve visualization, does involve using various dyes to look at lesions, and then if there's a need, women in America with the best medical care sometimes undergo a procedure that might involve cryotherapy or such approach.
Oh, okay.
This will only work for early stage lesions.
Right.
Now, cervix cancer often is a disease which, if caught early, can be cured if allowed to grow without annual screening by physicians, can be a deadly disease.
Mm-hmm.
So this would only work in Thailand and other countries which have high incidence and high mortality from cervix cancer mm-hmm. if women are screened on a regular, hopefully even annual basis.
Right. Right.
Now, what cervix cancer is, among many other things, is a virus-related malignancy. I wouldn't say it's caused by a virus, but there is a strong association with some sexually transmitted viruses and the incidence of cervix cancer. So this is a public health as well as a cancer issue in many countries. And you're correct, even a country as close to us as Mexico has a very high mortality rate from it. And if this kind of approach, you know, can be seen, and I think the most important message in this story is if there are women who feel, number one, have access to a clinic, and number two, feel they can go there and be treated effectively, you know, that's great. But again, it's going to require annual visits to some kind of caregiver who knows how to do a pelvic exam on a woman to make sure there isn't a need for this regularly.
Because one of the criticisms that was even mentioned in this article is they called it poor medicine for poor people. But what you're saying is at the early stages, this is very viable and very effective.
Correct. If during a same clinic time in the same village in somewhere like Thailand, a woman's detected with a more advanced stage of cervix cancer, this will not be effective.
Right, right.
In there, the two curative approaches involve fairly sophisticated delivery of radiation therapy or surgical removal.
Right.
And either one of them is going to be beyond the scope of, you know, village medicine in many places.
Right.
When I visited the National Cancer Institute in Mexico City, the number one malignancy being managed there by the radiation oncologist was cervix cancer. And if you go to any center in the United States, it's really a rare disease in those same departments.
Oh, okay. So you bring up something very interesting. And you know, we try to have people understand medicine, science, technology on a very basic level. That you're right, I did find one study that mentioned iodine and other staining techniques. And is what you're saying is they're sort of staining it directly and looking for an abnormality as opposed to the pap smear, which requires taking a sample, staining, sectioning, looking it under a fancy microscope with a, you know, an oncologist who really knows tissue pathology and things like that.
Right. And, you know, I think there's a complementary role of both. But clearly what happens is in American medicine, the gynecologist on an annual basis will inspect the cervix.
Right.
If the cervix appears abnormal, but if the cervix appears by visual inspection to be normal, but the pap smear is abnormal, then the next step will be what's sometimes referred to as a colposcopy or a dilatation and curettage, where they actually will put a device inside the cervix and do scrapings. But it also involves, if there's an abnormality right on the cervix, then staining and selective biopsies might be done. If it's found to be just a superficial lesion, it can be cured by a very localized procedure, be it cryotherapy or a surgical device done just right there in the office.
Right, so dilatation and curettage, D&C.
Correct.
Okay, which a lot of people only associate with abortion-type stuff, but in fact, it's a very useful diagnostic tool.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, and it's part of the follow-up for many women who do have an abnormal pap smear.
Okay. So let's start with cancer itself. Why is it so difficult to diagnose, to treat, to understand? It's just, it's the worst thing ever. Am I overstating that?
Well, it affects all of us. You know, every family has patients or family members who get cancer, everyone who has friends who've suffered from it. Cancer is a term that really involves several hundred diagnoses, some of which can be cured with surgery alone or some other approach, and some of which really are rarely cured. But, you know, we really are at a point where we understand some of the fundamental nature of cancer far better than we used to. But every cancer and even sometimes every case of a certain type has a different story. There are cancers which can be cured with surgery and the patients just have to come for follow-up. There are others that we still feel like we need new tools to understand them, let alone treat them. The cancer, the good news is the number of people dying from cancer compared to the number diagnosed is going down in this country, But cancer, for a large part, is a disease of aging. So as the age of our population, particularly the baby boomer population, ages, the number of cases of cancer in this country will not go down in terms of absolute number.
Okay, so sort of a double-edged sword.
Yeah, the number, you know, if you look at the cure rates, even in tough diseases like lung cancer, they're incrementally going up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, breast cancer, same thing, colon cancer as well. So the major diseases, we're seeing progress, and yet the number of people diagnosed as we age as a population continues to go up as the number of people in this country.
Right, and I would also think that characterization and diagnostic tools are getting better. So what we might have thought was something else decades ago, we now realize are all these newer forms of cancer we're learning about.
Right, and there are times perhaps where a person who was older and had some kind of stroke-like situation, the imaging never was done to show there might have been a brain tumor underlying that. And now that's done even in people who are in their eighth or ninth decade of life.
Ah, okay. So so let's maybe delve into some specific treatments, and hopefully this is going to give us some good news. And both of you work with radiation, right? So what is radiation oncology? And eventually we're going to get to try not to scare people, because people are scared of radiation. Is that still true? Are people still scared of radiation?
Okay. Well, it's serious business. So I think having a wariness about radiation exposure is appropriate. The tools that are used to cure or help people with cancer with radiation have really come tremendously forward in the last years and decades. Radiation is one of the two common approaches that can be used to cure cancer. Mm-hmm. Out of all the cancer patients seen today, about 60% at some point or another will probably receive radiation therapy. Mm-hmm. So it's part of the two blocks. And if you think simplistically, either surgery or radiation can be used as either together or by themselves to manage a localized problem. And chemotherapy, which is the medication side, can supplement that approach. When a cancer is perhaps spread through the body, then chemotherapy or some sort of system-wide therapy is the more common approach. But I think we understand the limits of all of those therapies. Sometimes radiation can be used to avoid a large surgical procedure. For example, it was only with the use of radiation we were able to have curative treatments of breast cancer without removing the entire breast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that was landmark work. We know that radiation is a very good alternative for many men with prostate cancer, as opposed to having their prostate removed.
Right.
We know now that there are certain people who have very early stage lung tumors where a very pinpoint type of radiation is now being evaluated as an alternative to surgical removal of an entire portion of a lung. So when you think of it as a non-surgical alternative to surgery, that's something that I think is understandable. Radiation exposure, we understand the risks and benefits of it, and we spend tremendous amount of time limiting unnecessary radiation exposure in the medical environment, whether people are just going for scans or x-rays to do a checkup or whether they're being used, you know, for actual treatment.
Mm-hmm. And as part of this, just due to the fact that not only professionals, but the public at large have a better understanding of radiation. I mean, you know, I was recently up at the National Academies building, and I saw this great photograph that I've mentioned before of, you know, General Groves and Dr. Oppenheimer touring the glassified surface after the Trinity test. And it said, ironically, General Groves, Dr. Oppenheimer, and the photographer who took this picture, this was an exhibition of his work, all died of cancer within 12 years of that photo. I mean, we didn't understand things. We used to put open source x-rays in shoe stores that would shoot ionizing radiation all over the place. So now we have a much better understanding of radiation.
Yeah. No, I think so. This is Tim. And, you know, I think as a physicist in the medical field, you know, one of the things that we work with the physicians on a daily basis is trying to direct the radiation to the cancerous tissue to the tumors and also try to avoid that to unnecessary areas. And our focus really in radiation oncology is more around the area of therapy. We have also diagnostic imaging mm-hmm. with CTs and X-rays. Mm-hmm. We use that a lot in our field too, but most of what we're looking at in radiation oncology and trying to treat cancer is we're using particles such as electrons. We use X-rays, photons every day. And in fact, at Emory, you know, we're looking to bring in protons, which is kind of a new area for us too, which has a new kind of particle dose distribution that makes it very attractive for radiation. So we try to bring all those tools in and work on that in the technology area and work side by side with the mm-hmm. physician to achieve the goals for radiation therapy.
Okay, great. In fact, that was going to be my next question. I wanted to get into the nitty-gritty of it. Because when we say radiation implies anything that has wave-like properties. It could actually be photons or small, sure. you know, particles like this. So after the break, I'd love to ask you about these different types of things and what are the advantages and disadvantages of, say, electrons or photons or, right. or neutrons, protons, whatever it is that you're planning on using. So. All right, that'd be great. So if you are listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1 and have a question or comment about this fascinating topic for Tim or Wally, by all means, give us a call here at the studio. The number is 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Way to start your Friday off right? Look no further than Coffee and Sushi, airing every Thursday night, Friday morning from midnight to 1, right here on Rec. I'll be mixing chill out, lounge, down tempo, and just about all kinds of smooth, ice cold grooves. Every edition delivers fresh tracks from one of the most overlooked genres in music. Check out the most recent playlist at wrk.org/coffeeandsushi. Soul with Coffee and Sushi every Thursday night, Friday morning at midnight, right here on 91.1 FM WREK. Elevate your soul.
It's not hard to find the best reggae that Atlanta has to offer. Know your roots. Keep it simple. Tune in to 5446, Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where today's program is The Battle Against Cancer, News from the Front Lines, and our guests are Wally Curran, Executive Director of the Winship Cancer Institute at Emory, and Tim Fox, Director of the Division of Medical Physics and Associate Professor of Radiation Oncology at Emory University. And Tim was telling us about the sort of radiation they use. Basically, you aim this radiation, and that's what I want to ask you about next, is the aiming, the focusing is much better than it used to be at the cancer, basically, and then because it's ionizing radiation, it is not a good thing for tissue, basically locally kills the cancer. Is that how it works?
Well, yeah, I mean, once you get to that area of DNA break, you know, the biological effects take place, but what we mm-hmm. usually deal with is the physical interactions. And, you know, what's happened over the last 20 years is we've gone from using photon energies of 6 MV, so that's 6 million volts of, you know, in terms of energy. That's typical what we would use for a linear accelerator in a department today in radiation mm-hmm. therapy. And so what we typically used to do is sort of treat with a square field. We treat with a uniform field of radiation, And what happens with that type of radiation energy is that the maximum dose is deposited right underneath the skin surface. So it gives us a nice skin sparing effect. Like it can be about, a little bit less than a centimeter under the skin that you would have that effect. But what happens is the dose quickly falls off. Mm-hmm. So the technique used in radiation oncology for external beam radiation is to crossfire these beams from different angles at the tumor. And so now you're building up all the energy at the tumor location. But to get there, you are depositing energy along the way, mm-hmm. and we're trying to minimize that. Over the years, we've taken a square large field of like 30 by 30 centimeters, and we started to sculpt it and shape it into shapes so that we could kind of conform that dose really around the tumor volume. Right. And then over the last 10, 15 years, we've been able to break that beam up into small pencil beams. We refer to them as pencil beams or beamlets, where really they're like about 1 by 1 millimeter, you could think of, or 1 by 2 millimeters. So we've been able to break this pencil beam down and vary the intensity to each one of those different pencil beams as we deliver it. Mm-hmm. So essentially paint the dose and intensity into the tumor. So we can vary the intensity at that level. And that's been referred to as a technique called intensity modulated radiation therapy. So we use a lot of acronyms. We have that, that's called IMRT. And that came about around 2000. And so by using that, we could really start to get very tight conformal dose distributions and really come around the tumor volume. But with that, we also needed to make sure that we're hitting the target. And that was the big piece of over the last 10 to 15 years we brought in, or last 10 years, we've brought in imaging into that treatment process. So we can do what we call image-guided radiation therapy. And so we can use imaging to guide that. We've always used lasers to set up patients in the room to make sure they're in the right position every day. So we've always used that, but we also supplement that with what we call image-guided radiation therapy. Mm-hmm. So the advances over the last 20 years have been remarkable, and they kind of computer development.
Right.
You know, as you see the developments in technology the software systems have been improved along with the hardware systems. And so we've been able to take advantage of that in the field of radiation oncology.
So what you're saying is decades ago, they'd have radiation, they'd expose you as close they could to the relevant tumor. But now what they do is they'll take these pencil beams, focus them from all these different angles, and it sounds as though you can even vary these over time to minimize the tissue damage between where it enters and where it hits the tumor. But if they're all sort of aimed at one little peanut-shaped thing in the middle, that's where you get the biggest accumulation, the biggest damage to the tissue that you want to hurt, right?
That's correct. I mean, we really can vary that intensity, and then we can vary the energy that's going along. So if we all of a sudden see we're traversing through the spinal cord, we can turn that pencil beam off and use the ones that go around the spinal cord. The software systems, a lot of them use, you know, what we call optimization technology, some of the same technology to schedule airlines and trucks and other things like this. We use some of the same technology of optimization to make this a mathematical problem that they solve. And the whole key to this was really bringing in medical imaging into treatment planning, three-dimensional planning in sort of the mid-90s, where we could bring in a whole CT data set. Uh-huh. The physician could outline the lung, the spinal cord, they could outline the tumor area and essentially say, this is what I want to hit, this is what I want to avoid. And the physics team would work on achieving that prescription. And then they would work with the physician hand in hand, and we would evaluate the plans, work through that in an iterative style till we came up with really the best plan. So it could take, you know, almost 5 days from the time a patient really gets their first image to when we really first treat them to go through that team approach. So it's a really, that's the thing we like about radiation oncology, is it's a team approach where we have the physicians, the physicist, our therapist, kind of working together for this type of therapy.
Right. And in my opinion, it represents the maximum geek out, right? Because you talked about optimization, that's mentioned in one of your research areas. The canonical optimization problem that we give to freshman and sophomore engineers just to get them to think outside the box is exactly that three-dimensional radiation problem. You know, we say, how can you get this dosage delivered here but not too much tissue damage along the way? And the solution is this three-dimensional pointing of all the pencil beams, and then you can do the math, and it's a great illustrative problem for us. So is that true, then, basically, of most cancer treatment, certainly things that involve radiation oncology, that you're going to be talking to a physician, you may be talking to a pathologist, you're going to be talking to a radiation guy, you're going to have a whole group of white lab coat wearing confusing people. Do patients freak out at that?
Well, like at Winship, you know, and Wally can talk about this too, what's great is they, like I remember yesterday, we were trying to get a hold of one of the physicians, he's in brain tumor conference, you know, and so the patients that come in with brain tumors, and I've had some friends that have suffered from that, you know, they can come in and see like a medical oncologist, a surgical oncologist, a radiation oncologist all at one time, you know, in one setting in one day and get that consultative, you know, and then the radiation oncologist might come back to a physics team later and say, we've got this case, you know, here's what we want to do, and we want to work with this and this and this, and they've gotten input from the surgical group too. So it's, you know, that's the part that's interesting in a place like Winship, which is what I know, is how we kind of work with disease site specific, you know.
Right. So that makes perfect sense to do, you know, real-time consultation, because my collaborator over there used to be a vascular surgeon, and they want to cut, and the other guys want to do other things. So, but you have the guy that cuts, the guy that does the radiation, and the guy that understands the diagnosis to say, look, this part responds well to cutting, then we'll do radiation first, this sort of thing. But I also know that Emory has programs with these patient advocates, you know, because the average person with a bunch of MDs and PhDs in the room would not necessarily respond well as their patient advocate. Now, here's Tim. He's the physicist guy. Now, Wally's coming in. He's the physician. Calm down. It's not as bad as you think.
Yeah, I mean, we have a group of individuals known as patient navigators who help get patients through the various appointments, imaging, and consultations. And there's also cancer patients who have been through all of this who want to do what they call peer-to-peer support. And so we help them with a little bit of understanding the confidentiality issues and what things we've learned are helpful. And that's a tremendous support. I mean, there's nothing better than having someone who's been through what you think you might be facing a year ago can tell you what was the tough part, you know, what would be useful. That orientation is invaluable.
Right.
And we're delighted that there's actually a large number of people who've been through this who really sign up to offer peer-to-peer support. It's been great.
So I want to get back into the use of imaging to help this, right? But before we do, we actually had a caller call in, and correct me if I'm wrong, their question, Trent, was what makes pancreatic cancer more virulent than others?
Sure. So pancreatic cancer, certainly with Stephen Jobs, is certainly in the news, but he actually had a subtype of pancreatic cancer where the possibility for cure is actually higher than most pancreatic cancers. Mm-hmm. Pancreatic cancer is tough for three reasons. Number one, the pancreas is a tough area to do successful and complete surgery without difficulties. There's a high rate of metastases or spreading from it, and there's also a high rate of invasion of adjacent tissues. So often before someone with pancreatic cancer has symptoms, with the most common symptoms being kind of difficulty eating, weight loss, or pain, the tumor has had an opportunity to perhaps spread or to invade adjacent tissues or go to the local lymph nodes. Now, that doesn't mean we're not making progress against it. There's much better imaging, speaking of imaging, of pancreatic cancer than there used to be, so there can be a decision about whether surgery should have a role or not. There's some new drugs that are approved on the radiation side. I think we understand what dose can be helpful and what dose we're able to give. But it's still one of the most challenging types of cancers. We're fortunate at the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory to have a whole team, and it really does take a village to deal with a disease like that. Surgical specialists, imaging specialists, doctors who give chemotherapy, doctors who give radiation, And we actually sometimes involve our surgeons who have expertise in organ transplant mm-hmm. in this disease as mm-hmm. well. So it's a very tough disease, but we see people, and Mr. Jobs is not the only person who experienced long-term survival, mm-hmm. which he truly did in this disease.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm seeing is probably the single most important thing about radiation treatment is the non-invasiveness compared to surgery. And you happen to mention the two types of cancer for which that is the most important, breast cancer and prostate cancer, right? So breast cancer, obviously, no one wants to do radical mastectomies and a complete resection of that because it's very disfiguring. And then with regard to prostate cancer, tiny little donut-shaped organ that you go and you start cutting, they can really get good survival rates. But there's a lot of sensitive stuff around there, including nerves that impact sexual function and things like that, that every guy my age who has friends who've gone through this, that's the one thing nobody likes to talk about. So for example, are there other ways of delivering radiation? For example, you could take something that is slightly radioactive, and I know I'm scaring some of our listeners now, pellets, things like that. I mean, can you put pellets that will release ionizing radiation as well?
Yes. I mean, in the prostate, you know, besides external beam therapy, which we'll do, you know, we also deliver what we call prostate seed implants or radioactive seeds. And part of the way this is done is, you know, these small rice-like pellets that are radioactive, like I-125, mm-hmm. Giving off lower energy, are inserted into a pattern. We actually use ultrasound imaging to guide that. So we'll use ultrasound imaging to guide that needle placement, and we'll put a pattern in there that gives us the right dose distribution. So in this case, we're radiating from the inside out.
Mm, okay.
And this is a permanent implant. They'll stay in there and they'll decay away. But there's certain stages of cancer for prostate where that would be effective, and we do this with the physician in the OR room with a urologist, radiation oncologist, a mm-hmm. physicist doing ultrasound guided seed implants. And so it's another place where, you know, imaging, all kinds of imaging are being used to help us essentially, that you can boil it down to, if you can, you know, see and treat, you know, so if we can see the tumor, we can treat the tumor, mm-hmm. especially when it's these solid tumors. And right. So the more imaging we use and the different types of imaging modalities and the combination, we think gives us more information.
Mm-hmm. And there's also temporary radioactive implants that are done as well. Going back to the question earlier of cervix right. cancer, cancer of the uterine cervix, it can be, you can cure some cases in some stages of mm-hmm. Cancer of the uterus or cervix just by putting a temporary radiation placement in hollow tubes mm-hmm. inside the vagina, inside the mm-hmm. uterine canal for a certain amount of time.
Right, right.
Historically, we would put it in for 2 to 3 days while a woman remained at bed rest. Mm-hmm. Now we have higher intensity, more automated sources where a woman will come in, might have the radioactive sources put in for 10 minutes. They come out and they come in the next day and get another 10 minutes worth. So mm-hmm. they don't have mm-hmm. to be at bed rest and all okay. the side effects okay. of that.
And the one overriding thing I'm hearing from you is that now it's no longer, trial and error. Right? For example, I taught the first biomaterials course here, and one of the best examples we use is vascular grafts. That the first ones were sewn out of ladies' handkerchiefs, and it was very trial and error when they did it. But now what you're doing is you're placing the beams, you're placing the pellets, whatever it is, this radiation source, you're doing the mathematical model of how this dissipates, and you're seeing exactly what the coverage is, and you can tailor it for the shape of the tumor and the position of the tumor. So really what you're doing is using modern physics, you know, mathematical optimization methods to minimize the exposure to healthy tissue, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, and we, you know, using all these techniques have been kind of a key piece of technology over the years, you know, exactly like you've described.
All right, I think we've actually got a caller on the line this time. Welcome to Inside the Black Box. Did you have a question or a comment?
I have a question.
Yeah.
What role does Zytiga play for someone who has end-stage prostate cancer and it's already metastasized to their bone?
So what is Zytiga?
Zytiga is a drug that people take when they have end-stage prostate cancer? I know it's just recently approved, but what role does it really play, and how does it really help someone who's got metastatic prostate cancer that's already spread to the bone and it's uncurable?
All right, I'm not going to take this question. Any thoughts, gentlemen?
Yeah, so you are correct, and you're using the brand name for that, which is fine, but the way that that agent, as well as any other agent, gets available to patients is to have gone through rigorous testing a large number of men with prostate cancer in what's called the hormone-resistant stage of prostate cancer. They either received that agent or they didn't, mm-hmm. and a benefit was noted with the use of that agent. And so as a result of that, now that's being offered as an option without a study. Mm-hmm. The part that I want to emphasize is every new therapy, particularly the medical therapies, but also the surgical or radiation therapies, are only available to us as cancer patients or potential cancer patients because there were trials. Mm-hmm. And cancer is still an area of discovery. And one of the things we're committed to at Winship is offering patients clinical trials, which to us usually means we'll offer you the best possible care we know how to do, mm-hmm. and there may be something additional or there mm-hmm. may not be. And
right.
everyone should feel free to accept or decline that option. But it was men who had this stage of prostate cancer who underwent that. And I've seen the early results of that study. I'm not sure there are publications yet, but I've seen the presentations on it. And the results, particularly for men with bone pain, look very promising with this approach.
All right. Well, let's hope it continues to be promising. All right. Thanks for the question. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we've actually got some questions relevant to this nasty, heterogeneous nature of cancer, that it, you know, all the different types of cancer are different. There are subtypes within those types of cancer that are different. And then even the same type of cancer is different in so many different patients. And that's why whenever you see those studies about markers, they'll be like, well, there's an 80% chance if you see this marker, but it's never 100%. It is almost like a custom disease. So we'll continue with that when we come back. And again, if you've got a question or comment for our guests, give us a call here at the studio. If you're listening Wednesdays live, noon to 1, at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box. Science only funnier.
You know who you are. You know you have a problem. How it's all slipping away under your feet like quicksand into an agonizing vortex of lies and pain and stupidity. You know, life. Life sucks, and we understand. We're the Church of the Subgenius, and we're here with proven therapies that can help you survive your daily hell march by giving you the ability to laugh in the face of the horror. Indeed. To laugh your guts out. The Hour of Slack and Bob's Slack Time Funhouse deliver a solid 2-hour dose of psychic medication to armor you against the deadly friction of your everyday existence. That's midnight Saturdays on WREK Atlanta. The Hour of Slack and Bob's Slack Time Funhouse from the Church of the Subgenius. We don't know exactly what we are, but we know for sure that we're not them.
Sci-Fi Lab, where librarians, producers, fans, and gamers gather to talk about all the best in science fiction. Thursday nights at 7 here on WREK Atlanta.
So before the break, we were talking about the challenge of treating cancer, that it's almost like a customizable disease, that it varies so much. We actually had a call before the break with a question. Is it true that cancer is difficult to treat because it's constantly mutating?
I would say the answer in general is no to that. You know, there are mutations that we continue to see more and more in different diseases, but the number of examples where we can say in a given patient over the span of their fight against cancer that there's continued mutations, we just don't have that documentation. We see examples of where that happens.
Right.
We don't think that's the rule. We think that's the exception.
Okay.
We think that what happens is there's a heterogeneous clone of cancer cells even in the same patient.
Right.
So let's say you give a therapy that wipes out 99%. That 1% that which could regrow may have more resistant clones. So if you looked at the genes in that compared to the genes of the original 99%, they're different because they're more resistant. But that doesn't mean there was a shift. It was really a population selection.
Okay. And that is the big problem. In fact, we've got a guest talking in the School of Chemical Engineering, Kaushal Rege from Arizona State, who's looking at delivery of some of these things using nanoparticles. And basically, it's sort of that early stage. And oncogenesis is a very poorly understood thing. It's not, boom, an event happens. And then there are sort of stages. And that's why therapies are sometimes effective at one stage and not another. And it's not so much a direct mutation as it is a change, a stage-wise growth of this thing.
Yeah. So just to give you an idea of how rapidly our understanding of this is changing, 10 years ago, there were no different therapies for lung cancer, which is the number one cancer killer of men and women in this country and around the world, based on any kind of genetic information. We now know that for a certain type of cancer where there's a mutation, there's one therapy that's better than others. We now have identified, just in the past 5 years, another gene mutation, which might affect 3 to 8% of all lung cancer patients, and we just had FDA approval of an agent targeting that gene mutation. And we know 3 or 4 other mutations. We don't have drugs for those targets, but we also realize that in 5 to 10 years, we'll probably know of other genetic mutations.
So, but what you're saying is a cancer that's typically associated with environmental conditions, maybe lung cancer, actually has a big genetic component, and that explains why, you know, everybody has the one uncle that smoked like a chimney 2 packs a day and never got lung cancer, and then other people got it.
And in fact, both of these mutations are more associated with light smoking or never smoking histories than the ones for whom we don't know about gene mutations.
Right.
I'm saying I can't say don't have gene mutations. We just don't know about them at this point.
Okay. So we've got another caller in the line.
Hi.
Yeah. What's your question or comment?
I had a question, a couple of questions. This is all very good news. I'm really interested in it. My questions were, what states are manufacturing the radioactive medicine materials? And also, third world countries, you mentioned Thailand earlier in your discussion, third world countries that want to provide these services to their citizens and residents, how can they, do they develop their own industry or do they buy it from industrialized countries?
So, you know, I don't know off the top of my head exactly what states the radiopharmaceuticals are being developed in, and maybe Tim does, but what I can tell you is that the fight against cancer, fortunately, is a worldwide fight. And the gap between what's available in one country and another is fortunately narrowing, both on the technology side and the pharmaceutical side. I attended the International Association Against Lung Cancer meeting this past summer, which happens every 2 to 3 years. There were representatives at that meeting from 100 countries. So, and there were papers of discovery from around the world. So in countries that we've considered historically not technology rich, they are and we are seeing opportunities for them to have both diagnostic and therapeutic approaches to cancer that just were totally unforeseen. Doesn't mean that there are not areas of there's unquestionably a maldistribution of expertise against a lot of medical problems around the world in some countries versus another. But I think the use of internet and other things is really allowing an international dialogue and an international fight against these diseases. Mm-hmm. Tim, I don't know if you know much about the geography of manufacturing.
Right. I think the one there is, I mean, it's spread across the United States and probably across the world. Actually, there is a company here in Norcross, Georgia called Therogenics. They actually make an I-125 seed for prostate implant. They're just right up 85. And, you know, they're a company because I know there's a lot of Georgia Tech graduates that actually work there too. So, you know, there's local people making radioactive seeds. And there's, I know, groups in Canada as well. So,
thank you.
Thanks for the question. That was great. So basically what we're saying is, given just the universal nature of cancer, right, that as we cure all these other diseases and life expectancy goes up, cancer is going to be something you're going to have to deal with. And that's always the case. As we cure one disease, another disease takes its place. So cancer is very prominent now. Because of its prominence, everybody's interested in this sort of stuff.
Right. And let me just mention, Tim and I have been leaders on our campus of a event coming up this Saturday. I'll do some shameless promotion, known as the Winship 5K. You can learn about it on our website. But the part I wanted to emphasize is we have about 1,100 participants registered already, and over a third of them are self-identified as cancer survivors.
Oh, wow.
So I was really touched by that, the fact that these are people who are coming out to help bring attention to our fight against cancer as both an institutional commitment but a worldwide commitment. But that, keep in mind, that also means that they are physically able to at least get out there and walk, because it doesn't have to be a run for some, if not all, of a 5K. So that, to me, was really an exciting bit of information I learned.
And maybe that's the best testimony for modern techniques and their success in fighting cancer. And actually, we've got links to both you guys on our website, insidetheblackbox.org, as well as a link to the Winship Cancer Center. So you can go there, get to the Winship Cancer Center. It's right on the front page. I saw it. I was out of town. Otherwise, I would be running. Before we get out of here, I do want to ask Tim one more time. So the role of imaging, right? So now, by imaging, maybe a lot of people don't understand this. We've had experts on MRI imaging. Alan Tannenbaum's been in here, and he describes these colon fly-throughs like a roller coaster, right? You know, you'll either take CT, which you mentioned, cathode tomography, CAT scans, or MRI information. Do you do any of that? I mean, obviously, you look at those beforehand to try to figure out where the tumor is. Do you do any of that in situ?
Well, what we do is we'll take a lot of imaging, what we call pre-treatment imaging. So diagnostically, we'll take PET imaging, which is positron emission tomography, looking at metabolic uptake of tumors, depending on different types. We'll do the MRI. We'll do CT. We use all that for an anatomical map of the patient for treatment planning. Mm-hmm. When we're in the room with the patient, treatment delivery room, our linear accelerators have really become like a Da Vinci robot, a surgical unit that we're able to really sculpt these tumors. And so we use actually in-room what we call cone beam CT to take volumetric images of the patient or x-rays to help us position that patient accurately. So we use it for patient positioning, targeting of the tumor, but we also can use it in a feedback for head and neck patients, cancer patients. They'll tend to lose weight over therapy. We can verify that we're still hitting the target. Mm-hmm. Our goal is to never miss the target, to hit the target, to make sure we're delivering the correct dose to the patient. So we use the imaging now for that. And then in follow-up, patients come back for additional imaging that's used by the physicians. And we can quantify that with the pre-treatment imaging, too. One other thing I wanted to say, too, is that, you know, another piece of information is there will actually be on this campus in December a medical linear accelerator with image guidance capabilities installed in the basement of the Boggs building here for the medical physics program. So tech students, there's about 17 medical physics graduate students here at Georgia Tech, you know, that work in this program. So, you know, for students that are interested in this, you know, they should contact the nuclear engineering department here, get involved, because there's a lot of advanced research that can go into this to help improve imaging, improve targeting, and work with the actual machine that's used at Emory to treat patients. It's going to be a machine that will be on site here for that use.
And what you're reminding is students that might be interested in technical fields is when you think of nuclear engineering, well, we think of actually the nuclear engineers have nothing to do with bombs. I know those guys. Those are the device physicists that I meet when I go out to Sandia and Livermore. But you think of nuclear reactors.
Homer Simpson.
Yes, exactly. And that's certainly going to frighten everyone. But actually, you know, medical physics, and we actually work with people that use positrons, and they are making beams of these things, and we use them to characterize free volume distributions of materials. But there are guys that are actually thinking about what could I use those for in medical diagnostics and things like that. So there is this whole area that is only growing, it sounds like, with regard to both treatment for cancer as well as imaging, that someone who's interested in the nuclear field that doesn't want to work next to Homer Simpson might want to think about.
Exactly. There's a lot of people on the tech campus that have, we've worked with industrial engineers on optimization. Mm-hmm. We've worked with the biomedical engineering groups here on MR imaging. Our physicians work closely. There's groups in nanotechnology. So, we would encourage the engineers to reach out to the people in the School of Medicine and especially in Winship and look at ways that they can assist in research projects. And really, there's a lot of translational research that probably could be done between the two different groups.
Yeah, and there's already a lot going on. Yes. I've actually been over at the Winship Cancer. They did some protein synthesis for us on some meganin peptide work we did years ago. So there's a lot of those collaborations. Hopefully there will be more. But basically what you're saying is, you know, not only do we do all this imaging to figure out exactly where the tumor is, what its distribution is, what its shape is, now you're actually using some of that imaging for the aiming, right? So you're actually looking inside the body to make sure you're hitting exactly the picture you got from the MRI or the cathode tomography or things like that. But here's the thing. You know, you can do that to look inside, but eventually you got to strap this guy down. Do they still tattoo people for the aiming point?
Well, with image guidance, we don't have to do as much of that because what we do is we may put some marks on the patient, maybe with a marker, with a permanent marker that will come off later. But and we use immobilization devices, and these aren't anything that's really invasive, more like a mask that goes over the patient's head for head and neck treatments, or maybe a body cast that kind of keeps them in the same position as they lay on the table. But all this is non-invasive, and the marks are usually on the device. Then once we get the patient situated, we can use the imaging to then fine-tune that. And so we've learned that marks on the skin don't necessarily, you know, when you move outside the brain, marks on the skin don't necessarily always correlate with what's underneath.
Right.
And so the imaging helps us with that.
All right. So as we reach the end of our program, that was my last cheap attempt to squeeze in a tattoo joke. We've gone an entire show without being funny at all. Possibly appropriate given the nature of our topic today, but I'm going to try to summarize nonetheless. So cancer is very difficult because it is just so heterogeneous. That's probably the best way to describe it. They're making progress all the time, a lot of progress in the last several decades, such that the treatment landscape is entirely different, right? So, for example, in lung cancer, we've realized that genetic screening is also important, and that speaks to the heterogeneity. Everyone's different the way they manifest lung cancer and other things. The value of imaging is very important. And that underscores the fact that now cancer treatment, whether it's radiation or chemotherapy or surgical, is a team approach. And the best way to maybe do this is the way they're doing it, Winship, is to get all those experts right in the room up front and see what part can be treated by radiation, by chemotherapy, by surgery. It may be a little intimidating, but luckily Emory's got, what did you call them, patient navigators? And some peer-to-peer counseling to say, look, I know all these guys in the white lab coats. And trust me, you are intimidating. You don't realize you are, but you are. Maybe get those guys calmed down to do that sort of thing. You've also seen that just plain old technology, mathematical modeling, and the same optimization techniques a lot of engineers at Georgia Tech learn are very important in focusing this on a particular area, you know, sculpting the tumor you mentioned. And that because of the general nature of this, it really is an international fight. So given the international nature of this fight, hopefully you will check out the Winship Center webpage or our webpage to get there. And come on out. What was the date again on the Winship 5K?
This Saturday, October 15th, 8 a.m., right on the Winship campus, right by the field house.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the program.
Great. Yep. Thank you, Pete. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Pete.
And unfortunately, I will not be here. I will be at the University of Minnesota appearing in front of the Alpha Chi Sigma chapter, trying to raise money for them. So come out and support your favorite chemistry geek. And then please join us next week when we're actually going to have Sandy Magnus, a Georgia Tech alum, and the only woman to fly on the last space shuttle mission will be joining us to talk about the value of the space program. If you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
Parallel the advances in medical imaging and even